Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today on the podcast, let's talk about social media and how everything has morphed and changed for patients and plastic surgeons. And I'm here with Dr. Akash Chandrawarkar. Welcome to the podcast. He is a researcher. He's a brilliant guy. We're going to learn some things now. Hi, Akash. How are you?
Hi, Dr. K. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell everybody who's listening a little bit about your scholarly background, because you're a plastic surgery resident physician right now at Johns Hopkins, and residency is super hard. I don't even know how you have time to do any of this research. Tell us a little bit about what got you started into plastics.
Sure. I came from an engineering background growing up in New Jersey. I went to MIT for college, following those engineering dreams of mine. But was really interested in the human body. The greatest engineered structure there is the human body. So that naturally followed me to go to med school. I went to Harvard for med school through the Harvard-MIT joint program in health sciences and technology. While I was there, I took a year off to do research with the face transplant team, spearheaded by the plastic surgeons. And that got me really interested in plastic surgery, seeing really how restorative surgery could be. It's not just a life-saving operation that you can do, but you can do a life-restoring operation. And thinking about quality of life really pushed me into the field of plastic surgery. I'm a chief resident now at Johns Hopkins, about to graduate in a few months.
That's amazing. So the face transplant team, that is super incredible. I was so delighted to see that. Tell me about that experience. Were you actually in the operating room? Did you get to meet the patients before and after?
I did. I got to do a lot of that in clinical research with the patients. But on the back end, I was doing a lot of research doing virtual face transplants on the computer and showing them to the public to see how much of the post-transplant face looks like the donor or the recipient. A big ethical issue in face transplantation in the early days was, is the donor face going to stay on the recipient, and will the loved one see, for the person who's passed away, will they see them walking around and, create some levels of anxiety about that?
Think about that. Do you guys strategically change the transplanted face to prevent that psychological trauma?
Well, what we found is that you're replacing a lot of the soft tissue and some of the bony structures, but what actually ends up happening is the way we perceive faces and identity, it's a holistic kind of approach that we take to understanding the face and understanding identity. And there's been a lot of anthropomorphic research done in this from the 80s, where how do we see somebody as an identity? And it takes, facial shape, the entire shape of the face with the different structures in the middle. And we found that a lot of the people who saw the virtual transplanted faces, they actually thought that the post-transplant face looked more like the recipient than the donor. So that was kind of a study that we did to really show that this is a worthy cause to go forward with, and maybe some of these ethical issues can be assuaged.
I think that would be very traumatic to have a donated face walking, into a room and seeing a previous image of a loved one. But it's interesting because the face does change and morph to fit the skeletal bone structure under it. Right? I would say that the skin drapes on the bones in a way that's going to be different and not as recognizable. So have you been using artificial intelligence research, and what are you doing right now in terms of tracking the human face? Is it possible to track facial aging changes with points placed on the face to see how they change over the decades?
Yeah, I think that is possible. With artificial intelligence, you can take thousands and hundreds of thousands of faces and put them into essentially an algorithm that will be able to predict, if you give it a new face, what the age looks like and what the attractiveness is. So for example, if you're doing a procedure like a facelift, patients want to know, well, how many years will this take off and make me look how much younger, 10 years younger, 15 years younger? It's really hard for any of us to say, but what artificial intelligence can do is take the before picture and say, the before picture looks this old based on the thousands of pictures and hundreds of thousands of pictures we have in our database. And the post facelift picture looks this old. You can do that over many patients and then really give patients a little more information about how different procedures can make them look younger or better. And by how much, giving them a little customized ability to get a bang for their buck. Maybe a blepharoplasty would make them look more attractive, but may not reduce how old they look because it makes them look less tired. So it'll help patients really better understand what they're going in for and what the expectation is on the other end.
Definitely. So how many facelift images have you guys analyzed? Have you come to a conclusion how many years younger a facelift can make you look based on thousands of digital images?
Well, the kind of difficult part there is getting the number of facelift images.
The hardest part is standardized images on Instagram, exactly. On social media, in plastic surgery offices, in my own office. That's the hardest thing, is to get standardized images.
Yeah, they need to be unfiltered, without differential light. The computer can only analyze what it gets in. It can't go back on whatever the raw data you give it is. So kind of commonly they say in artificial intelligence, it's trash data in, you get trash data out. So really controlling for that is really hard for us. There are companies like Microsoft who have developed databases of just regular, people's photos, and they can accurately tell you what age somebody looks like if you input their face. They can even tell you emotion, what's the probability of male versus female. So we can use those tools to do these studies, but we still need the proper amount of before and afters to come to real conclusions that will be generalizable across the population.
You did a year at Stanford doing a biodesign innovation fellowship, and you must have learned and seen a whole lot. Are we going to be living in a world where literally the facial scanning is happening over and over already, and we're bound to have bioidentical facial mapping and sensors that will be able to detect these changes in people's faces?
Yeah, I think the computing power and the ability for us to continue to collect data will allow us to do really incredible things, so our patients can really figure out what's the best decision for them when they're going around trying to figure out who to go to for surgery, what type of surgery should be done, should I be getting filler or should I be getting a facelift. I think individualized medicine and precision medicine is a big buzzword in lots of different fields like cancer research. But we haven't really talked about it in plastic surgery because it's almost assumed that, plastic surgery is individualized medicine. But the patient really doesn't understand sometimes what they're getting into. Some people may do a better job with a certain type of face in doing their facelift or rhinoplasty than a different doctor. The different surgeons have different styles. So for a patient to kind of the ultimate goal would be a patient can have a very personalized simulation of what their experience will be like and what the results will be like, and be able to choose from there whether they should get a multitude of surgeries done. Should they get non-invasives done? Should they have it done by this person versus this person? And I think it's all for the better for patients. For surgeons, it'll also help with setting expectations for patients. And I think, the best relationships happen when patients and surgeons really match expectations. And, there are problems that occur when those expectations are not the same. So I think it's helpful on both ends.
How has COVID-19 affected you guys in plastic surgery and training? Have you had less exposure to patients? Have you felt like less teaching going on, more focus on just treating COVID patients?
You know, I think we've gone through a few waves, but within plastic surgery, on the reconstructive side, things don't slow down. So trauma still happens, despite people, needing to stay at home. A lot aren't, and the ones who aren't are getting into trauma, car accidents, things like that. And then also cancer still happens, COVID or not. And so the cancer reconstruction side is still there at the same volumes. We had to scale back some of the surgeries that took up hospital resources like ICU beds. But we kind of pivoted, tried to figure out what in our care of these patients requires ICU level care and tried to alter that. For example, we do these surgeries where we transplant flaps from one part of the body to the other. And sometimes it takes in the post surgery period, really careful monitoring by the nurses. Now that doesn't have to be done in an ICU setting. We were able to kind of teach floor nurses how to do that. And then therefore open up ICU space for COVID patients or potential COVID patients. The other thing we saw is that aesthetic interest has gone through the roof. So right now we're, as we allowed our resident cosmetic clinic to open back up, we're flooded with cases and, trying to tell people when they'll be able to get at the end of a big backlog of cases that need to be done. So it's been, I don't think we've had any devalued education. I think our case volumes have stayed pretty high. Especially at Hopkins, which is a big kind of tertiary care center, quaternary care center, where all the complex stuff comes to, that stuff's all still going to keep going there. The one interesting thing is we've had a lot of education by Zoom since we can't meet in person. So we've had actually, I think, a increase in the quality of our didactic education. We're able to get people from around the world in our grand rounds, without having to fly them out and have them stay in a hotel. And it's a little painful process for them to do that, to give a lecture to us. Now they just wake up in the morning and they turn their Zoom camera on and can teach us. We can have the experts teaching us everything.
That's amazing. That actually has been a big plus. Have you felt that aesthetic surgery has changed at all in this marketplace? We have been extra busy in California. I don't know about in the East Coast, but what do you think has driven that change? Is it the Zoom dysmorphia of everybody seeing their faces on Zoom images all day long that makes you want to have things corrected or adjusted?
This was the question that we had, sometime last year, because we kept seeing all these lay pieces in magazines talking about Zoom dysmorphia. And a lot of the surgeons saying, this is driving our aesthetic volumes through the roof. But those were all really anecdotal. And we really wanted to kind of hone in on getting real data on why aesthetic surgery had increased interest. So we both looked at it from Google search trends for different things to get some quantitative data. And then we also queried the public through surveys online to ask them, for patients who had increased interest, what were the reasons why you had increased interest? And if you have decreased interest from before, why were those reasons? And these just got published in our most recent issue of Aesthetic Surgery Journal. So you can catch the full article there, but it was really a stark change in Google search trends right after the pandemic hit. And then it took a few weeks for that to come back to normal and then push through to being higher than normal. Mm-hmm. Search terms for different body parts, like double chin, were going through the roof. Forehead were going through the roof. Wrinkles initially went down and then went back up to normal after a few weeks. So we were really able to get a pulse of what people were searching for, because that's a good way and really has been validated to show and mimic what the interest is of the public in a variety of aesthetic procedures.
So Google, if you were looking for your own practice to research what's trending, what's popular, you'd go to Google Trends or Amazon, looking up Amazon Marketplace, you said?
It's Amazon Mechanical Turk. So basically, you can go on Amazon Mechanical Turk, and there's a bunch of people who taking surveys all day long. It's a survey website, and people will go on that and do surveys all day long for you pay them to take these surveys, the public, and they answer the surveys. You put some questions in there to make sure that they're not just selecting C for every answer, attention questions, and then you sort out who's actually answering those properly. And that has been validated in plastic surgery literature and other fields to get a good sense of public interest in whatever you want to ask for. So
if you're researching for your own office, for your own Instagram, to see what's popular, what's trending, those are two tips you could recommend. Google Trends, and I've never even heard of Amazon Mechanical Turk. But
I think they're really useful because you can get answers very quickly to specific questions. For Google Trends, it's a very passive way of finding out. But what people are searching for, people are interested in. So you will, for plastic surgery procedures, you see very good seasonal variations that are repeated every year for a variety of procedures. Abdominoplasty, facelift, rhinoplasty, those change throughout the different seasons for a variety of reasons. And it's pretty consistent every year. For Mechanical Turk, you can get answers from 300 people within 5 minutes. It's pretty incredible how you can get really quick data, and that's great for a practice because you don't have time to do a full study and go survey people on the street and send out questionnaires and have them returned. It's really nice, and I think if you're trying to explore your local market too, you can put filters and questions so that you can see what your local market is and what people's thoughts are on things, because that'll help you connect with your community.
When did you start with that, actually? And do you work for them, or are you just in your colleagues?
I was shortly after my time with Biodesign, and I spent some time while I was out in Silicon Valley with the Life Science Angels Investment Group doing a lot of due diligence on companies. I was introduced to Dan Holton, the CEO of Cypress Medical, kind of as an evaluation of his company by one of the investors. And, I gave some feedback, and then we started talking, and I have been helping them with their clinical strategy as kind of in an advisory role. I think it's a kind of interesting, very simple device that has a lot of good implications, which I think are some of the best medical technologies that have real simple mechanisms, easy to understand how they work. And then the applications are kind of very varied. So I think, that really excited me. And we've done a lot of cadaver labs, testing out the device, and it's kind of been a fun journey to watch that company grow.
Have you actually tried the device?
I have, and I've helped help onboard some surgeons and some surge techs on how to use it. And I think it's really simple and easy to use, and people who kind of understand facial anatomy understand how to use it. I think every surgeon has been in the unenviable position of trying to throw a suture from far away with a very long needle driver. The physics just don't make sense, and the biomechanics of your wrist don't make sense to throw that stitch accurately. And this this exact device does fit that need, especially in facial plastic surgery and plastic surgery, where we are trying to affect change far away from an incision that we're trying to hide somewhere else on the face or on the neck or behind the ear. That's where it really becomes very useful. So I think they created a really great device for an unmet need.
Definitely. I think it's going to be quite helpful for non-invasive modalities of doing facelift and neck lift, especially in office procedures. Let's talk a little bit about the responsibility of surgeons in maintaining professionalism on social media, because there is a lot of advertising, editing, and photoshopping and claims that are made on Instagram and Facebook and other places that I think are affecting our industry. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's really hard because social media provides such a great avenue for education for patients. And there's so many people who do it well, like yourself and Dr. Kim. And I think that's a really great way for us to reach out to our patients and have them understand many things, like what's the difference between filler and Botox, and when would I need surgery, and what's an implant made out of? These are all great things that people are being exposed to, taking the stigma also away from, you know, getting a facial rejuvenation or a breast or body procedure. But with the good always comes the bad, and you see people who are advertising things that may not have the effect it does. there's a lot of filtering and potential photoshopping going on. And you have patients coming in expecting that result. And I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier. When expectations aren't aligned, there's problems. And when you start having unrealistic post pictures or after pictures, and patients are expecting that, and that's not something anyone can actually deliver, it creates a problem. I don't know if have you run into this with any of your patients having some unrealistic expectations for...
I mean, I see it all the time in terms of influencers using beauty filters and people representing their facial attractiveness in an exaggerated, you know, extremely perfect manner, which leads patients, women and men both, to self-critique so viciously that they feel that they're not beautiful, they're unattractive, that they need to maintain and attain the standard of beauty that's unimaginable and not even possible without the use of a filter. So it's morphing our sense of reality quite a bit, and it's giving people the expectation that filler can deliver that beautiful perfection when it really is just a syringe with a hyaluronic gel that can add volume.
Right.
It can't deliver like a new life or a new approach, you know. But I think people see these images and they interpret them as real. They really do. So
yeah. And I think the other
thing. It's funny that the human brain wants to give the benefit of the doubt to the person. So even though you see your favorite influencer or model using the filter every single day, your brain wants to believe that that's who she really is, even though you know it's a filter.
Right.
It's this perception drift.
And I think the other thing that it also alters is the ability for somebody to really figure out how to choose an injector or a surgeon. A lot of the most experienced surgeons I know are not Instagram savvy and don't know how to Photoshop and don't know how to do that stuff and don't even post that many before and afters. But they're the people who write the textbooks. And then you have other people who are trying to break into the industry or may not even be surgeons or may not be qualified injectors, who are trying to, you know, use social media to try bringing patients on board. And I think that really confuses patients because their idea of what is expertise is based on what they see on social media. And that's just not true in most cases. Even when I'm talking to friends who are asking me, who should I go to for this procedure? They will say, yeah, you know, that person, I know they're the person who wrote the textbook, but I don't really like their Instagram. And I like this person, their Instagram is much better. And I said, I don't even know who that person is, but
yeah,
it's tough for patients to figure out what quality is with all these confounders.
Do you think that we can write up standards for professionalism that will be endorsed by our industry and our leaders and our, you know, society members?
I think so. I think there's a lot of pushes for that with board certification and people falsifying or misrepresenting themselves. That's not looked upon very well. In our residencies, one of our core competencies for graduation in the communication section involves appropriate use of social media. So it's being included in our training.
That's nice.
And we even looked at how plastic surgery programs have adopted social media so that the residents could learn to use social media appropriately, professionally, instead of trying to emulate, you know, somebody who's not playing by the same rules.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the people who are not doing things professionally on social media, they don't have anyone to report to.
Mm-hmm.
So they will keep doing it. They may not have board certification in an ABMS field or anything like that. I don't know how to combat that, because you can't stop somebody who doesn't have, you know, a parent running around telling them what's good or what's not.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult for the consumer to even understand what is professionalism in terms of surgical standards of what we think, what societies of surgery and medicine think is appropriate. Interesting, this new world of social media that we're in.
How have you figured out how to engage your patients, but you do so well, and educate them and stay professional and not toe that line, not jump over that line, which I think is probably easy to do, but you guys mm-hmm. have done such a great job of it. How do you balance that, and what rules do you have in your own?
Keep it educational. I think this is my chance to show patients a view into my daily life and bring them into the exam room with me, and they get to meet a patient. I'm always so respectful of the fact that this person has allowed their image to be used, and patients are very giving, like they're giving their experience to others to learn from. And it's only because they've seen and learned from other women or men on my Instagram page that they're willing to be posted. The average patient who sees me has followed our account for like 2 years. So it's not just one exposure. It's the repeat every day delivering like good results, ethical behavior, and professionalism. And patients, the human brain is a computer. And it can tell when it sees a good set of hands working and someone who's knowledgeable and someone who can speak quite comfortably and fluidly. So I think people can just get a sense of your degree of professionalism. But I just try to keep it edutainment. It's educational, but it's entertainment too. You have a channel that you're putting on a show every day, and you really have to deliver like something interesting. Otherwise, nobody's going to watch your channel if it's all the professionalism in the world and it's super boring. So it has to also engage people and make them feel relatable.
Yeah, if I was doing a TV show of me running numbers with my junior residents in the morning, it probably wouldn't be too interesting.
No, you have to show the drama, the fun side of things. But it's great that you guys are learning during residency how to do Instagram and social media. I think that what would be very helpful is to have, like I said, standardized photography protocols where as I was talking to one of your colleagues, Christian, we talked about artificial intelligence being able to detect when people had put filters on images or photoshopped or face-tuned, before and after pictures. I think that's going to be so nice to even have some kind of stamp or mark of authenticity that these are undoctored images you're looking at. That's going to be great. But
I think the beauty industry has been pushing towards that. We saw a campaign from CVS a few years ago that they're not going to have any filters or airbrushing on their models for any of their health products.
Yeah.
I think people are understanding that, you know, all these filters and Photoshop, they're creating these unrealistic expectations for, children and you know, adults alike, and kind of growing up, many of these kids are growing up in this era where they're just seeing a lot of not real things, but aspiring towards that.
So it's really quite challenging because it makes you feel imperfect all the time. And it makes you even dislike the unfiltered view of your own face. Like you see your own face and you're like, oh, I need a filter. Like, okay, that behavior, we've all done that, but we need to stop doing that. And I find it so interesting that men don't really use filters in the frequency that women do, because men probably don't post selfies as often as women do, if I could generalize and say a very stereotypical statement like that. But I really, in the office all the time, hear women saying, oh, can you put a filter on that? Whereas the guy patients are very generally not so particular.
You can grow facial hair to cover our imperfections.
That's right. That is right.
But, you know, kind of going back to tying in the COVID and the social media, you know, one thing our study found, looking at the reasons for increased interest for aesthetic interventions over over the COVID pandemic, one of the highest things was people spending increased time on social media. And actually lower on the list of things was noticing something on a video or Zoom conference. So, you know, it may not be so much the Zoom dysmorphia, but it's actually the Snapchat or whatever you want to call it, Snapchat dysmorphia or Instagram dysmorphia, that people throughout the pandemic have been at home and they're sitting on their phone scrolling through Instagram. And so they're, you know, seeing more of these unrealistic things, I think. The other two that were seeing themselves in the mirror more often was one, and then the desire to look better when the crisis is over. Those were top three reasons why people had increased interest.
I think that's absolutely right. The more time that you spend scrolling, the more you want that life that's, you know, it's aspirational beauty. And I think that's just human nature to aspire to have that better, next better thing that you don't currently have. But it makes you dissatisfied with your present condition quite easily. So do you predict changes to happen once the pandemic lifts, or hopefully the pandemic will lift?
We're going to rerun our data to kind of see how the how these original data that we got has changed in the last year. We're coming up on a year from, you know, when the pandemic was announced by the WHO. I think we'll continue to see plastic surgery and aesthetic surgery interest and injectables on the rise because people are now going to be going back out into the world.
Wait, I have a question. How do you think AI is going to interpret facial fillers when it compares people's faces, like these ladies with mounds of Voluma in their cheeks and, you know, especially the overfilled face? Do you think that's going to morph the AI algorithms that analyze human faces?
It could. I think the penetration of the public with the number of people who have such so much filler that it really changes their how their identity is perceived by either your phone or application. I think that's a really small proportion probably, and maybe goes back to the face transplant study. You know, we were able to move someone's entire face onto another person's face and people still thought it looked like the recipient, not the donor. So, you know, maybe even though we make all these changes, we're doing all these things, the goal, I think, is to maintain your identity. And definitely, you hear that rhinoplasty patients so much, you know, that you don't, they don't want the look to change their ethnicity. They want to still look like them. And I think that's where the nicest, kind of subtlest achievements that these patients have, who have the most realistic expectations, end up being. To be themselves, pressure themselves.
Definitely. I think that's people are a challenge, though.
Yeah, and I think post-pandemic, people are going to want to go back to, you know, how did I look pre-pandemic?
Actually, probably yes, but So I think the level of cortisol and stress that's been running through everybody's system has aged us all 10 years extra. This year has gone very,
it's been a long year.
It's been a long, hard year. We're ready for a spring rejuvenation. Well, it's been so interesting chatting with you about trends in artificial intelligence, and I'm sure that you have a wealth of knowledge and going forward in your career. What are you doing next year?
I'm doing a fellowship in New York City at MEEF. It's one of the ASAP's endorsed fellowships with kind of some of the giants in facial surgery, as well as some body surgery. So it'll be really good for me to get some advanced training. And then I have to find a job after that at some point.
Join the real world. Well, enjoy educational residency and fellowship while you have it. It's a really great time of your life. And it's very amazing that you've done all this research, took time off and did this whole Stanford fellowship training. And I think you're going to become a great member of our aesthetic profession. So where can people find you if they're interested to reach out or learn more about your research on aesthetics and AI and the future?
Sure. My my Instagram is Dr. Akash Chand, DrAkashChand. And you can reach out to me there. I also want to thank you for, you know, having me on this program, and also for all that you do for patient education and really showing the public the realities of plastic surgery. It's really helpful for all of us that you're setting the bar really high for patients to have a great provider.
Well, there you have it, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in to Beauty Bites. There are so many more secrets ahead in the future. Instruments that reach far into the face, artificial intelligence, mapping the human face, face transplants. There's so much technology to come. Our field is still in its infancy, I really think. It's the first 20 years of having Botox and fillers, and so much more to come. So I can't wait to see the day when we can scan a human face, map its aging trajectory, anti-age it, you know, planning ahead where you need your filler, where you need various treatments to keep you super natural, and maybe even stick you in a machine where you just get that all zapped without any needles. Won't that be great? That's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram doing amazing things with people's faces. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DrKay. And our website is the same. It's beautybydrk.com. That's where you can find my awesome skincare line. And don't forget to try my new collagen powder and hair, skin, and nails vitamins. That's it for now, and stay beautiful.